We have to have 15 million witnesses before anybody's going to look into the problem. Seriously? This is more fantastic than flying saucers or people from Venus or anything, as far as I'm concerned.
News, science, space and the cosmos, exploring our past, our future, and the mysteries of our universe. Taking a critical look at reality and a journey to the edges of human understanding. The future is now. This is the Graylian Report with Micah Hanks.
From the high mountains of Appalachia in a bunker below ground, welcome one and all. It is the Graylian Report. I am glad to be your host and with you again for another occasion as we go looking for the mysteries of our existence. Continuing the modern Grail quest as we do every Monday night from 6 to 8 p.m. East Coast time worldwide around the globe via KGRARadio.com, our home here on this darkest little corner of the web, and we have a lot in store for you tonight. We're going to be looking at the launch of a revolutionary new technology by the U.S. space program. And then I've got to jump over into the animal kingdom corner for a while because we've got all kinds of delightful and also some very compelling news in the realm of zoology that we've got to cover tonight. And then looking back into history, later in the program, we're going to be delving into probably what is one of the most widely recognized UFO sightings of all time. In fact, it is the one that put flying saucers on the map. That occurred on this day, as of the date that we are recording this program, in history. And yes, that involves a pilot from Idaho named Kenneth Arnold. And my, have we ever found some entertaining audio from that era that is going to help illustrate this story. Because even when you've read popular books on this subject, they can include all of the news articles, all of the interviews, all of the testimony. And what's fascinating about looking back in time like this is that you begin to see the way that the narratives change as it's being retold over time. And when you look back, it's almost undeniable in hindsight that that's part of what was going on. But the question is, if he was mistaken about what he saw, why were other people reporting that they were seeing similar things? And if other people were reporting seeing similar things, and this trend continued on throughout history, were they all mistaken? Were they all seeing light reflecting off of the bellies of geese, in other words? And that's why I think it's important, as we're looking at what Kenneth Arnold and others around that time were reporting that they saw, we're also going to go back before the 1947 era, and we're going to revisit very compelling audio from a World War II pilot and his account of having encountered what were called at that time Foo Fighters. And again, putting together the narrative, there seems to be a fairly good case that there were unusual things being seen in the sky during and after the Second World War, very much like what's happening right now and we're reading about so much in the newspapers. So getting a historical perspective on the subject this week. But before we get into all that, of course, we have a bit of news that we need to cover first. And I'd mentioned that there was something exciting, revolutionary, and groundbreaking that was being announced by NASA just today. It was a big day for NASA because they reached another milestone with the launch of a brand new atomic clock that they put into orbit using a Falcon Heavy rocket. And the space agency said that this new clock isn't just going to be telling time. It could actually change how we engage space exploration for years, maybe decades or centuries to come. Now, Live Science reported that the Deep Space Atomic Clock, developed by NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory, is a space-ready upgrade to the atomic clocks we use here on Earth and to the clocks that already fly on satellites like those that provide GPS. And to elaborate on this a bit, NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California, issued a statement, and they said that to determine a spacecraft's distance from Earth, navigators send a signal to that spacecraft, which then returns it back to Earth. The time that that signal requires to make the two-way journey reveals the spacecraft's distance from Earth, because the signal travels at a known speed, which is, of course, the speed of light. Now, while that may sound complicated, JPL said, most of us use this concept every day. Again, our smartphones rely on GPS technology, mapping technology that we use in our vehicles when we're driving. All of these things involve a lot more of the concepts outlined by Einstein in his theory of relativity than you probably would think. Now, NASA reports that by sending multiple signals and taking many measurements over time, navigators can calculate a spacecraft's trajectory, where it is and where it's headed. Most modern clocks, from wristwatches to those used on satellites, keep time using a quartz crystal oscillator. And how this works is that these devices take advantage of the fact that quartz crystals, yes, vibrate at a precise frequency, but I'm not talking about mystical energies and spirit vibrations here. This vibration occurs when voltage is applied to them. Now, those vibrations of the crystal do act like a pendulum of a grandfather's clock ticking off how much time has passed, and thus helping these timekeeping pieces perform their functions. To know a spacecraft's position within a meter, for instance, navigators need clocks with precision time resolution. In other words, clocks that can measure billionths of a second. But ultimately, utilizing an atomic clock in space like this may make spacecraft navigation to distant locations like Mars far more autonomous. And of course, more efficient for those who are the ones doing all the traveling. Now, I should point out that isn't the only space news that we have this week, and a fun one that all the sci-fi fans out there are no doubt going to appreciate involves a NASA spacecraft. This one wasn't putting an atomic clock in space. No, it spotted a curious shape on the surface of Mars. It wasn't Bigfoot. It wasn't an alien base. Didn't involve roads. Didn't involve faces. No, this one was far better than any of that. This one actually resembled almost perfectly. In fact, if you look at the photographs, it is almost perfectly the Starfleet logo from the sci-fi show Star Trek. Now, Sky News reports that the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter captured images of a series of the chevron-shaped contours on the surface of the red planet, and posting an image on Twitter, the Mars Watchers said enterprising viewers will make the discovery that these features look conspicuously like a famous logo. But before diehard Trekkies go into warp speed, scientists say that any resemblance is purely coincidental and not a calling card from Captain Kirk and the crew of the Starship Enterprise. At least that's what they want you to think, right? Then again, I'm probably just a paid debunker. I had to have a laugh over the weekend because a negative review that somebody left on this podcast on iTunes argued that I was probably a paid debunker. They were saying, yes, Micah Hanks is being paid to debunk everything. And he said where he really lost me was when he said that hills and mountains might have inspired the construction of pyramids. And I did indeed say that. But to me, it also doesn't seem entirely unlikely. I'm saying that often people in the ancient world were probably trying to create things, monuments and the like, in ways that mirrored things that they saw in nature. People still do that today. In fact, we wouldn't have automobiles and aircraft if humans, since time immemorial, didn't actually try to mimic things that we saw in nature and replicate those processes. Many of the greatest technological achievements of our day are a result of humans trying to get around the limitations of what we're physically capable of doing. We observe a bird take flight and we say, why can't a human do that too? If we strap on wings and we even borrow feathers from a bird and strap those onto the wings and start flapping, we can't get off the ground. Why can a bird do it, but a human can't? And so making those kinds of observations about nature and trying to replicate the processes not only got human beings off the ground and into the air in the most rudimentary sense, but I would further argue that the technological progression that ensued thereafter led to not only more complex aircraft, but rockets, which eventually would carry us into space also. So yeah, I absolutely think that people observing things in nature probably drew inspiration from what they saw, and that led to great technological achievements, especially in the ancient world. But of course, we also still see the effects of that occurring today. So call me a debunker. I'm certainly not getting paid by anybody. But hey, at very least, the reviewer gave me 2 stars. If they really hated the program, I guess they would have only given me 1. Hey, if you like the program, I don't say it often enough, head on over there on iTunes and give us a review. Let us know that you love the Graylian Report. You know, a lot of work goes into this program. I certainly love doing the program with you. Now, moving on from space news, I did want to give a quick update in relation to something we touched on last week. We had an earthquake swarm update, and there's a new study that appeared in the journal Nature Communications. And what they have now reported is that some scientists think we are getting closer than ever to being able to predict when and where earthquakes are going to occur. According to lead researcher Dr. Zoe Milden, who's a lecturer in earth sciences at the University of Plymouth, earthquakes are caused, of course, by rocks sliding past each other along fault lines, which causes the forces and stress in the surrounding rocks to change after a big earthquake. Now, it's often assumed, according to Milden, that the nearest fault to a particular earthquake will be the next to rupture. However, our study shows that this is never the case. So if that's never the case, what is causing these earthquakes? Well, looking at the stresses caused by historical earthquakes, they say, is a step change in explaining why they are triggered. Now, one of the areas that they focused on for this study is Italy's central Apennines region, which is an area that has for centuries been hit by earthquakes, almost so repeatable that they can be predicted in that area, and hence why they would choose to look at that particular location. Now, the Daily Star reported that this shaky region holds records of damage and deaths by earthquakes in individual towns and villages dating all the way back to 1349. And yet again, we have this in the historic record, so we have a lot of data to draw from. Milden said that looking at those records of 700 years of records of earthquakes actually makes it easy to assume those incidents struck at pure random. But here's the catch. By combining that written evidence with state-of-the-art modeling, researchers actually found, and this is quite significant, a 97% hit rate of the earthquakes between the year 1703 and 2016, and they occurred on faults that were stressed by previous tremors. Now, why is this significant? Dr. Milden said that earthquakes are hugely destructive to both people and property, and the holy grail of earthquake science would be, of course, to predict where they are going to happen and when. They said, we are a very long way from that, and indeed it may never be possible to accurately predict the location, time, and size of future earthquakes. But, they say, our research could be a starting point in helping to develop better forecasts of which fault lines might be more susceptible based on previous tremors. So, that is indeed very good news. And one reason why, you know, if you look at the town of Amatrice in Norcia in 2016, there was an earthquake there. 300 people were killed in that earthquake. And being able to predict when an earthquake is going to happen, where, and what the potential severity will be, yeah, this would absolutely save lives and be a game changer for a number of other reasons, too, because consider the costly repair efforts after an earthquake ensues. I mean, it goes without saying there would be innumerable benefits to knowing when and where earthquakes are going to occur. But this is something that has fascinated me for a long time. And in fact, my good old buddies, Bill and Bob, are in town. And I've never had them on the microphone. I might have to get them on the mic at some point while they're here in town. Former engineers at Bell Laboratories and longtime friends of mine. I met them through our mutual interest in the Brown Mountain Lights. And years ago, when I was going down there to the Linville Gorge and looking for the lights, Bill and Bob would go down each summer. They would come down, and sometimes other colleagues of theirs, and they would come down and spend several days looking for the lights. Now, one of the conjectures about the possible cause of what are presumed to be natural luminous phenomena that occur with somewhat greater frequency in that area than other locations is the fact that right here in the region of western North Carolina, the Brevard Fault runs right through this area. And so what's interesting is that there are actually a lot of places where people report seeing lights like the Brown Mountain Lights. And over time and hearing stories like that, it's kind of led me to think that there may be a greater prominence of the appearance of lights in that area, but that's certainly not the only place in this region where they appear. In fact, I get reliable reports of similar light manifestations down in northern Alabama, all the way down near Somerville, South Carolina, definitely other parts of North Carolina. My mom and dad even described seeing one night. On the way home, they said that this beach ball-sized globe of light went floating up through the trees. So these kind of things definitely occur from time to time. But the reason I bring that up is because that idea is that these are earthquake lights may also be useful, in my opinion, in terms of being able to predict when earthquakes are going to occur. And there are videos online that show these rainbow-like, almost kaleidoscopic light bands that appear emanating from the ground in areas just before an earthquake occurs. So I would guess that there are a variety of ways that we might be able to combine our scientific knowledge of how to predict earthquakes, along with studies like those being developed by Dr. Zoe Milden and her colleagues and others. And of course, don't forget this one, animal disturbance as well. I mean, I have personally experienced the moment that an earthquake occurred miles and miles away where I couldn't feel the trembler occurring myself. I've had a pair of Rottweilers inexplicably start howling, and I'm like, what are you guys doing? And then I got the phone call, and people were like, did you feel that earthquake? And the reason that I made that connection between the dogs and their behavior and the earthquake is because there's all kinds of information in scientific literature that does make that observation. The problem is there aren't any known mechanisms for why that would occur. My guess would be, however, that our friends in the animal kingdom that possess varying degrees of greater magnetoreception and other sensory capabilities beyond the normal range for humans, that they just depict things like that. They react to it. And this would probably explain why, especially animals that utilize directional senses, magnetoreception for purposes of being able to navigate, birds, fish, etc., why they would often appear to be affected by seismic phenomena. And it's always kind of baffled me that despite the fact that there is a lot of information in the scientific literature that seems to make that connection, that animals with their sensory capabilities are more aware of the subtleties of their environment and they can pick up on things like that. I guess what stretches credulity for a lot of researchers is the idea that somehow these animals are able to predict the earthquake. But again, I would counter by saying that for humans, It may be perceived as a prediction, but I don't think that's what it is. I think that those animals are actually detecting very subtle changes in the environment that precede an earthquake. And so, yet again, if there are different phenomena occurring in nature that precede the actual earthquake itself and its devastation, we should be paying attention to the things in the environment that might help us make those determinations. So, quite obviously, I'm already getting into the animal segment, and since that's on my mind, I guess it's about time for us to go to the break. When we come back, I have a very unique update about some unusual behavior being exhibited by an aquatic mammal, and then also an update on one of my all-time favorites, the Architeuthis. If you know what that is, you know what awaits. The rest of you guys will have to wait until we get back. I am Micah Hanks. It is the Graylian Report, and we will return in a moment. So many of us already have our eyes on the skies these days, and I've got a very interesting story about something that was observed on radar out west. That's right, welcome back. It is the Graylian Report. You hear about these kinds of stories from time to time, unusual things that aren't only seen visually, but also are pinged on radar. And with all the UFO news we hear about these days, it probably wouldn't surprise anybody if I were to say that occasionally there are very strange things that appear on radar, and that's probably what the National Weather Service meteorologists thought earlier this month when they noticed something puzzling on their screens in Southern California. Now, appearing as a huge green blob, some first thought that the anomaly was a thunderstorm moving in. They said it was very strange because it was a relatively clear day and we weren't really expecting any rain or thunderstorms. This according to Casey Oswant, a National Weather Service meteorologist in San Diego. But on our radar, Casey told NPR News, we were seeing something that indicated there was something out there. Something really big. So this mystery object appears to be in the skies over San Bernardino County, and the National Weather Service meteorologists call the weather spotter there in Wrightwood, California. And when they get the weather spotter on the phone, they are told, yes, we know about that mysterious object, that cloud. It's actually a giant swarm of ladybugs. That's correct. This is known as a ladybug bloom, and I could have told them that, because every spring, one of those erupts inside my house. I don't know where they come from. Obviously, in the walls, in the ceilings. It's an old house. But I never bothered to get rid of them because, well, ladybugs, according to some superstitions, denote the presence of the Virgin Mary. So I just feel very blessed to have all these insects crawling around and buzzing around my home. They haven't hatched yet this year, but it being close to the summer months now, any day, I'm expecting some roommates to arrive. They come out of the woodwork quite literally around here. So yeah, I bet I could have told you what it was you were seeing out there, guys. Although admittedly, this is the first time that I recall ever hearing of a ladybug swarm appearing in such great numbers that it's detectable on radar. But that makes you think a little differently about UFO sightings too, huh? Next time a mystery object appears on radar, we should be wary of the fact that it could have been indeed a swarm of insects. Now, I'd already alluded to the fact that there is some big news in terms of zoology. This is aquatic zoology, to be more specific. And CNN reported that scientists Dr. Eddie Weider, Sonke Jonsson, and Dr. Nathan Robinson, part of a two-week mission funded by the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's Office of Ocean Exploration and Research, dove their cameras into the depths of the ocean off the East Coast to see if they could capture any life beyond that which the human eye normally sees. And here's what they reported. They said at just over 100 miles from Louisiana and Alabama, we made a historic discovery. A giant squid in what are recognized as U.S. waters. Yes, of course, the species otherwise known, as I mentioned earlier, as Architeuthis has fascinated me since childhood. This team deployed technology called the Medusa camera. No, it didn't have snakes on it, but it was fit with a special lure named the electronic jellyfish. And apparently during this trip, they used this thing five times to attract deep sea animals. Because infrared light is absorbed in the ocean, Witter, who is the founder of the Ocean Research and Conservation Association, told CNN that the light on the lure is uniquely designed. It's the same technology Witter used in 2012 to capture the first giant squid ever recorded on video in Japan. So if you want to catch a giant squid, use a light. And that actually makes sense. Just think about anglerfish. You know, there are actually deep ocean fish species that have natural bioluminescent appendages that they use to be able to hunt, because other species are attracted to their lights as well. Now, the camera's five deployments each took 24 hours to complete, so by the time Robinson sat down to review the film, there were over 120 hours of coverage, and the surprise was waiting at the very end. So imagine you're sitting there and you're reviewing 120 hours of footage from the deep ocean, and you're like, okay, cool, yeah, clownfish. Okay, cool, yeah, jellyfish. Cool, another jellyfish. Cuttlefish, jellyfish, jellyfish, jellyfish. Oh, God. And then there's a giant squid, writhing, tentacles outstretched and moving around the camera. Yes, you heard right, I said camera, and the footage is already online. Some of you may have even seen this. So Robinson said, I started to see a tentacle and I got more and more excited, and then the tentacles pulled back and there aren't words to describe. Now, he is the director of the Cape Eleuthera Institute in the Bahamas. He said that he then gestured to Witter to come and see what he had found. When Witter came over, he said that there was a moment that it dawned on them that history was being made, because this is the second time, at least for Witter, in her career, that she has managed to capture footage of a giant squid, but this is the first time that one has ever been filmed in U.S. waters. So these big guys, despite being elusive, they certainly can get around. And I admit to finding one of Robinson's statements about this discovery kind of funny. She said, they knew it was a giant squid for several reasons, but the biggest two were the body shape and the arrangement of the suckers. I'm thinking, yeah. Body shape, suckers, and the fact that it's massive. I mean, it was giant. This is a giant squid, too. So, yeah. Of course, you've got to keep in mind, giant squids, when they are born, are very small, just like any other infant. So they aren't always giant squids. They're just giant baby squids. In fact, I think I recall seeing a captured specimen of an infant Architeuthis, and it was maybe like an inch long. So imagine a species that could be that small at the outset of its life, and if it survives and it lives long enough, it grows to be large enough to take on a sperm whale. Yeah, that's pretty crazy. See, when I was a kid, all the other kids in the neighborhood, they liked Godzilla and Mothra and Rodan and King Kong, and I loved all those too. I won't lie. But that's why I love the giant squid too. I'm like, you guys think that those giant monsters are cool? Well, you stick with your kaijus, because look, this one's real. At that time, though, we'd only found their bodies. There hadn't been a live specimen observed. We didn't have footage of one alive in the wild. That only happened within the last few years. And that really kind of makes you think. I can't hear a story like this and not think, well, what else might be out there? Again, to that point, Witter actually said, this is the statement she gave, we all proceeded to go slightly nuts when we saw this thing. We know so little about how these animals survive in the depths. This helps us learn something more about how they hunt and their energy budget, and we need to know a lot more. In other words, this is an animal, very large, which existed only in mythology for years. The Kraken, for instance, believed to be purely mythological. And then the actual remains of these large creatures wash ashore. Science is able to document their existence, but we still hadn't found a living one. And it makes me wonder, I can't hear a story like this and not think, what else could be out there? What else that has been labeled a mythological animal might actually exist? We just haven't found that body yet. And here's another question for you. Are there giant squid in the fossil record? I don't know. I'm actually putting that out to the listenership. If you happen to know, I would love to hear from you. Tweet at me at Micah Hanks or info@MicahHanks.com. Although by the time you look it up, I probably will already have looked it up. And now I've opened the floodgates. I'm going to get all kinds of emails from people, but that's okay. I love hearing from you guys. So always send along news if you find it. And speaking of other animal news, yes, I was making allusions to the idea that there could be other large animals out there that exist in cultures and mythologies and things, but which are unrecognized by science because the body hasn't been found yet. And so naturally, we all get a little interested when we start hearing stories about a mysterious ape that is being seen in British Columbia. Yeah, unfortunately, it's not the legendary Sasquatch in this case, though. Residents of a British Columbia town have said that a monkey has been repeatedly spotted wandering loose in the area, and nobody knows where it came from. Baby Sasquatch? Probably not. They say the first sighting of the primate in Campbell River was reported last week by a Beeline taxi driver who said that the animal ran out in front of his vehicle and appeared to be a capuchin monkey. Yeah, residents said that the monkey has repeatedly been sighted in the area since the first incident, but no one has come forward claiming to own the missing monkey. Anybody lost their monkey? They might have thought they'd lost their marbles, if anything. Now, according to a UPI article, Lorraine Noel of the Campbell River SPCA said that there have been no official reports of a missing monkey in the area. I don't know how it escaped or who it escaped from. Noel said that the owner might be reluctant to come forward if the monkey is an illegal pet. They say that there are some that are sold in pet stores, but without knowing what type of monkey this is, I'm not sure if it's one of those exotic monkeys that should not be in the Campbell River. Yeah, it just goes to show, though, weird animals show up in the most unlikely places sometimes. You remember back in the day, the stories that we used to hear, especially in the 50s and 60s and up into the 70s, about what were called phantom kangaroos. And just today, there was a report released by police in Wisconsin who said that they are on the lookout for a loose kangaroo. That's exactly what was seen hopping across the highway near a walking bridge outside of Grand Chute in Wisconsin. That's right. Now, the Grand Chute Police Department said a caller reported spotting a kangaroo hopping across the walking bridge over Interstate 41, and that occurred at about 7 a.m. this morning. So Grand Chute Community Resource Officer Travis Wass said that the roo was reported heading east from Fox City Stadium. Officers wandered the bush and thicket looking for signs of the joey, but were unsuccessful. It would appear that the kangaroo had, wait for it, hopped along. That's what the police tweeted this morning. Where did the kangaroo come from? Right? Well, they said that they're hoping, the police, to consult with local zoos and try to attempt to identify the animal's owner if it turns up again. But this was quite a phenomenon back in the 1970s because, yeah, often you would hear these stories about kangaroos just showing up and there not being any record to account for where it might have come from. Anybody lose an exotic animal pet? Where in the world do kangaroos come from under circumstances like that? But the other theory is that at least under the right circumstances, if the climate conditions are conducive to it, and sorry, but again, if we're talking about monkeys and kangaroos, the last two places I would think that the climate would be suitable for those animals would be Wisconsin or British Columbia. But nonetheless, it is the warmer weather right now, and under the right circumstances, some of these animals may be able to persist for quite a while. And these stories I love because, again, animals are always surprising us. Point in case, by the way, there is a new study that was done recently with gray seals. Now, you may know, of course, that they're capable of a lot more than just being excellent swimmers. They can be taught to do tricks, and they're also really cute. But did you know that gray seals are also able to sing the themes from popular films and even mimic human language? That's what a new study shows. Sky News reports that researchers at the University of St. Andrews have trained three gray seals to copy sound sequences, resulting in a several-note rendition of songs like Twinkle Twinkle Little Star and even the Star Wars theme tune. And yes, we do have audio to offer as proof. Now, that's not the seal, by the way. What you just heard is the little sound that they're using to play the basic melody for the seal so that it recognizes the tune. And now what you're about to hear is one of the trained seals responding. Prepare yourselves. Oh, may the force be with you. Okay, getting there. Not bad, though. I don't think I've ever heard, maybe apart from birds mimicking a human, I don't think I've ever heard a mammal sing like that apart from humans. I can't think of another instance. These seals are doing a remarkably good job mimicking. Now, there's more. We've got also audio of them trying to kind of sound out vowel sounds and other things. We've got more of this audio. I'm just going to let it speak for itself. Oh, actually, I guess I'm going to let the seals speak for themselves. Poor little buddy's got a fairly limited vocal range, it sounds like. But hey, you at least get an A for effort. Keep in mind, again, those are the tones that are being played beforehand. You'll be able to tell the seals. That poor little guy sounded like he had something stuck in his throat. Well, what they're trying to do is mimic not only tones, musical tones, but also rudimentary vowel sounds. We continue. Now, if you watch the video, it's even cuter because you see them and their little mouths moving. But taken only as the audio like that, I mean, you almost don't think you're listening to seals there. It almost doesn't sound like the animal that you think you're hearing. And that's quite fascinating. Because over the years, we've begun to realize that there are actually a lot of different animals that might be capable of doing this. And the most interesting thing is, I'd said that there aren't other animals I've ever heard that were so closely able to replicate human sounds and even singing. But one animal that is believed to have similar language capabilities to humans are cetaceans, dolphins, porpoises, whales, and creatures like this. So what is it about marine mammals that would be capable, more capable of rendering speech similar to that of humans? That, to me, is truly fascinating indeed. But it kind of reminds me of something funny because there is a theory, and some of you may have heard of this before, the aquatic ape theory. I believe it's been roundly debunked. But the theory held that the reason that humans may grow hair primarily on the tops of our heads is because our ancient ancestors might have gone through an evolutionary stage where we were in the water a lot of the time. And further, that it was the water, the buoyancy of the water, and the support that it provided to our upper bodies that allowed human ancestors to develop the use of their arms as appendages for grasping things, rather than primarily for locomotion, like quadrupeds do. Now, of course, our ancestors, the arboreal apes, were already good at climbing. And so they naturally were already using their upper bodies differently from other animals because that was conducive to climbing. And being up in a tree and off the ground meant that you were probably better able to stay out of harm's way. But this theory about the aquatic ape was quite novel because it suggested that as these apes move into the water and are hunting for shellfish and things like that, that they were using their hands more in hunting for food, and that over time that might have led to evolutionary adaptations, which included the loss of hair on other parts of the body, with the exception of the top of the head, which would have remained out of the water, and hence the aquatic ape theory. Of course, we could probably surmise also that humans more likely lost the hair that grew on other parts of their bodies because we started supplanting the natural warmth of hair with covering that we were borrowing from other animal species when we began to make clothing. And of course, the hair primarily on the top of the head shields the head somewhat from the sun. It would make sense to me that evolutionarily speaking, hair would stay on the top of the head and not the rest of the body as humans began to don apparel more and more over time in order to guard ourselves in colder climates. And as we move out of Africa, ancient early humans that were moving north into the colder regions of the world naturally would have needed that kind of covering and garb. The question I guess I would have is, if we could jump in a time machine, go back and, you know, see what our Neanderthal and Denisovan ancestors looked like, how much hairier would they have been than we are? That would be the question I have. We actually carry some of their DNA with us even to this day. They are indeed our ancestors. But the question is, how much like us were they really? How much like them are we today? We still have a lot of questions about early human ancestry. I don't know that the aquatic ape fits into that picture anymore. But nonetheless, there's still plenty of other questions that do remain. It is the Graylian Report. I'm Micah Hanks. We'll be right back. Back, it is the Graylian Report. I am Micah Hanks. Yeah, still wondering about that aquatic ape theory. Actually, not so much that as whether or not those wonderful little gray seals are going to be the next mammal that takes up language like humans. You know, some of you guys probably saw on Joe Rogan's podcast recently that Bob Lazar and my pal Jeremy Corbell, who was the filmmaker of the Bob Lazar documentary, they appeared on the show, and although Bob's story is very controversial, some aspects of that story bear the ring of truth, and then there are aspects of it that just, I don't know what to make of them. I mean, it's really bizarre. Like the implication, for instance, that some of the aircraft that he saw at S4 might have actually been recovered during an archaeological dig. You know, certain aspects of the story just strain credulity. Nonetheless, something that kind of came to mind in relation to all of that had been, what if these were technologies that we developed? And what if, in order to be able to keep information about their creation, construction, etc., completely under wraps, above top secret, in other words, to borrow the term from Timothy Good's famous book on the subject, you know, what if indeed what they did was they brought in brilliant engineers, showed them existing technologies of our own, and instead of handing them an instruction manual and saying, improve it or fix it, they would say, we recovered this, this isn't ours, it's somebody else's technology, and now we need you to try and figure out how it works. That would seem to be a highly inefficient way to improve and expand on existing technologies that we built ourselves. But I mean, I'm trying to think of different ways that we could rectify the idea that we have these strange aircraft and the two sources of information about where they may have come from, according to Bob Lazar, are a archaeological dig, or that they came from Zeta 2 Reticuli, and that we either shot them down or we might have acquired them in some other way. But anyway, part of what was great about that interview, okay, and many of you guys, including Nate, who had sent me the link on Instagram, many of you were asking what I thought about that. And so I did actually have enough time over the weekend while driving around town running errands to be able to absorb most of that interview. And then finally, on Saturday night, when I was just sick and tired of working, because I'm in the middle of a big audiobook project right now, and I've been working a lot on weekends trying to get this thing done. But as I'm sitting there, I go to a little local tavern, and I'm sitting there, I order a beer, and I joke with the bartender and tell her, you know, I must look like a spook, you know, I'm the only guy that comes in here on a Friday night, and he's sitting here by himself with his smartphone and his earpiece in. But of course, in this noisy bar, how else am I going to hear this? And I wanted to finish this interview. So there I am sitting and having a Sierra Nevada and watching this interview. And one of the most fascinating things about the entire conversation was the kind of freeform chat that they get into between Joe and Bob and Jeremy, maybe a little past halfway through the interview. And Joe starts talking about evolution. And he says, what if evolution and this drive toward technology is just what we do? And then they bring up the fact that, yes, we've seen orangutans mimicking human behavior, and now they're starting to spearfish, and that they weren't actually taught to do this like these gray seals are being trained to do. Again, it may not be that the seals ever start utilizing language, you know, because they are dissimilar enough from us that they realize, if I can mimic this behavior, I'm going to get a treat. It's a trick. It's like teaching your dog to sit. You know, the dogs don't start sitting around and going, ah, you know, actually, the humans have been making us do this for decades, but this is actually really comfortable. We're going to start doing this all the time. I don't think they put two and two together, in other words. It's a behavior, in other words, that is accomplished through the reinforcement provided by the expectation of a goodie. But that fascinates me because we see that as a trick and as a novelty. I see that as, oh, these animals are intelligent enough to understand what we're telling them to do. And then they do it. They're capable of a lot of things. Yeah, they're really a lot smarter than we give them credit for. And they're obviously intelligent enough to understand the communicative aspect of all this, whether or not there is any kind of inclination on their own part, whether driven by intelligence or anything else, to seek to do these things on their own. In other words, thinking about it doesn't really come into the equation for them. This is just behavior, and they know that, hey, if I do this, this is what I get. This is the reward system that we have, this agreement. But nonetheless, there's a communication that occurs there, and that right there is just fascinating. But you take it one step further beyond seals learning to sing the Star Wars theme, and we look at apes that are mimicking human behavior because they are watching us do something, and they do recognize this is beneficial. Oh, funny, the naked monkeys, they have this cool way of catching fish. We've been using our hands. And so then orangutans start taking moderately sharp sticks and fishing with those. And so Joe Rogan pulls up the image and shows this to Bob Lazar in the interview. And they're all like, oh, wow, yeah, this is incredible. Now, of course, we could go in the direction of the Planet of the Apes idea here. But what was really fascinating to me about where they took the conversation, and again, all of this apart from Bob Lazar's bizarre story, which I'm not saying it's true or not, because I don't know. Everybody seems to have an opinion about Bob Lazar these days. Michael, what do you think? Do you believe him? I mean, I would say that again, if there are aspects of the story that seem so incredible, it makes it hard for me to take seriously completely the parts that sound more credible. But nonetheless, there are some parts that sound incredible, and hence why I posit ideas along the lines of what if he was only given limited information about what he was working on. And that is not unlike other systems of government that involve very specific need-to-know basis for projects. You know, you are only told what you need to know, and so if they can have a person come in and perform a function that they can do without having to have full knowledge of the scope of the project, the entire history, the background, etc., it's not inconceivable that a system like that might be implemented, but it seems highly inefficient if they're going to bring in engineers and tell them, yeah, we captured this. We think it's from Zeta 2 Reticuli. That one came from a hole in the ground in Turkey somewhere. Can you fix it? It doesn't really make sense, right? So I just don't know what to make of the Bob Lazar story, although Jeremy Corbell and I have been in touch, and he and I have communicated some, and he said he'd come on the program. In fact, I just need to line up a date and get him on here. I'd really like to get Bob Lazar on the show. There's some questions I'd love to ask Bob Lazar. Joe Rogan seemed very impressed with his story. But again, it was more interesting to me even than Bob's story, which most of us know by now, especially with the documentary that's out. Yeah, even more interesting than that was the discussion that ensued later about artificial intelligence, because Joe Rogan, talking with Bob Lazar and Jeremy Corbell, is raising a bunch of points about likelihoods in terms of what the technology or the intelligence itself might be behind the UAP we're all talking about now, that I have been arguing for years. He is very up to speed on the idea that, hey, what if this is just a natural progression of things? And what if, evolutionarily speaking, we are just, as I think he referred to at one point, paraphrasing a statement from another innovator, humans are essentially the sex organs of machinery. And Bob Lazar definitely liked that analogy too. And if that sounds weird, all it means is that, you know, eventually, after all of the steam engines and computers and cars and things, you know, humans are going to start making intelligent machines. But those things don't just build themselves. It's not like the AllSpark in Transformers, right? They have to be created, but once they are created, the superintelligence that ensues is far beyond anything we have done. In that capacity, humans are likened to being the reproductive capacities for even greater intelligences yet to come. I mean, that is fascinating to me. But in that line of thinking, Joe Rogan poses to Bob Lazar, the guy who claims to have worked at S4 on captured alien technologies. He's like, what if the technology is the result of AI that comes here? You know, what if the intelligences behind it are AI themselves? And again, I have made that argument time and time again over the years that it seems more likely in the context of trying to get around the problems, not of traversing great distances through space, but understanding how biology would even be able to do that. To me, it seems more likely, at very least in terms of probability, that we would be dealing with something synthetic, a synthetic intelligence. But for a synthetic intelligence to exist, presumably it has to have a point of origin. It has to have a creator first, which is terribly interesting to me. If God made man in his image, what will we make in ours? And more importantly, who is the God that created the things that might be buzzing around in aircraft in our own skies right now? Food for thought indeed. I'm Micah Hanks. It is the Graylian Report. And when we come back after this, I want to get to a few listener emails from you, and then we're going to delve into the historical analysis of the Kenneth Arnold sighting here on the anniversary of that occurrence right after this.
News. science, space, and the cosmos, exploring our past, our future, and the mysteries of our universe, taking a critical look at reality and a journey to the edges of human understanding. The future is now. This is the Graylian Report with Micah Hanks.
Keeping you company as we do every Monday night from 6 to 8 p.m. East Coast time, worldwide around the globe via KGRARadio.com. Welcome back. I am Micah Hanks, and glad as always to have you guys along for the ride as we go careening through space and time. It is the Graylian Report. That is what we do every week on this podcast. There's been a lot of UFO talk in recent weeks, and I have to say this is an exciting time to be alive, especially for a commentator, a longtime commentator on this subject. And of course, a lot of you devout and devoted listeners out there know that all too well. Many of you having already made your sojourn down here into the Hollow Earth yourselves to become Graylian X subscribers. And if you too would like to do so, it's easy to do. Just head over to Graylian Report, G-R-A-L-I-E-N, report.com/X. And you can subscribe. It's just $7 a month or $77 a year. That saves you an entire month on your annual subscription. And that gets you access to the weekly additional podcast known as Graylian X, or as we sometimes call it, the additional edition, as well as the Enigmas special. And we've got a new episode of that, which will be dropping here very soon. So something to look forward for all of you guys out there who are already subscribers. A lot of ways that you can show support for the program. And another way that folks from time to time do that involves writing in with news, views, perspectives, etc. And Nate did that this week and wrote, "Dear Micah, great show this week and thanks. This may be of interest to you for a mention in a future show. KIC 86-62-852 is a star some 1,480 light years away. There's something odd about the light that we see from it. The Kepler mission and associated citizen science project to identify exoplanets by the dimming in the light of their parent star isn't producing the normal profiles. Light level drops, light level recovers. At KIC 84-62-852, instead we see huge reductions in light level with an odd curve on the plot. Of course, one theory is that we're seeing the starlight shaded by an artificial megastructure, and one far larger than Jupiter. No doubt future space telescopes will allow for refinement in the data. What an exciting time to be alive." You know, actually, Nate is echoing my own statements with regard to the broader UFO subject. And again, we don't know exactly what the source of the technology is with what Navy pilots and others claim that they are encountering, and what we have some instrumental data also in support of. You know, there are conjectures that these things may be our own technologies. But, you know, if you're still on the fence about the UFO subject, and I'm always cautious with that one because, again, we don't know what we're dealing with. There was a skeptic on his blog recently that said, "Micah Hanks admits he doesn't know what UFOs are." And I'm thinking, would you rather I just make something up? Would you rather I lie and tell you that I do know what they are? You know, add to the ongoing conspiracy? Again, at what point, if we're really treating this subject logically, is it wrong to say, "I don't know"? To me, a good skeptic would do that. And of course, these days, you're going to catch flack because I think that the way that the ideological position on this, and I do have a couple more lines from Nate's email we'll get back to here in a moment, but again, I think that the ideological divide is either these things don't exist and anyone who talks about them, i.e. UAP, UFOs, in any capacity is silly. And it's even sillier if a person who is talking about a silly subject already says something like, "I don't know what they are." And then there's the other side, where people who are cautiously but with a scientific mindset looking at it and saying, "Well, we do have something. We don't know what that is. Could be our own technology. Could be something else." Proceed with caution. And to me, the best way to do that is to say, "I don't know," and be willing, bold if you have to be, enough to say, "I don't know what we're dealing with, but I acknowledge the potential." That's not bad skepticism on my part, and no, I'm not a paid debunker either. But again, take UFOs out of the equation if you're not comfortable with saying that you think that there's a thing there. You know, if you think that the UFOs are a nothing burger, leave that one off the table. And just look at the kinds of things like what Nate's writing in and talking about. Alien megastructures and other magnificent marvels of space. Many are already on the boat saying that, you know, within the next few decades, we're going to find evidence of life somewhere out there, whether it comes here and pays us a visit and we find it that way, or whether we're looking out there and we find techno signatures, which indicate that we've got neighbors farther off, but that nonetheless, they exist somewhere out there. So Nate sends along a link to Tabitha Boysian's TED Talk on the subject. And Nate, I do want to say, if you go back on our back catalog, yes, Tabitha Boysian's discovery, otherwise known as Tabby's Star, we've talked about it quite a bit on the program. And Jade, a good friend of ours and a correspondent of the program, who is also studying astronomy on the West Coast, keeps me up to date on the latest discoveries with regard to this. We haven't mentioned it in a while, and hence I wanted to share your email. And thank you for that. By the way, Nate also said that the flat earthers are quick to dismiss this as lies, of course, but we see here a good example of the scientific community's openness. And I think that's a great point because, again, there are such things as conspiracy theories, and then there are those things which, hey, we need a lot more data before we can get on board, but we're starting to see the scientific community become much more open to possibilities like alien life distant from Earth, and also some unusual things that we see in our own skies. We don't necessarily need to make any connections between those two things. I don't think we're to that point yet, but there are a lot of fascinating things. We're on the cusp of a lot of fascinating discoveries. So, Nate, thank you for your email. And also, I'm very happy to say that we've got one from our good pal James down the mountain this week. And he writes in and says, "Greetings from down the mountain, Brother Micah. It's been some time since I've written, but I would like to refresh your mind and your audience's mind on something that happened to me in the early 1990s. And this is due in response to the first half of your show when you spoke about cryptids and creatures that may be prowling around in our nation's forests. Now, I'm just providing you with a segment of my previous email, and I have one more story and some interesting information to add after this refresher. And here's a bit about my own experience." And he shares some of that original email, as he says, but since we're picking up a lot of new listeners these days, I will repeat portions of this. Some of you guys may remember this. In any case, it's a good refresher for most of us. And here goes. He said, "It was June of 1993. Me and my friend Bill decided to do some fishing in some old strip mining lakes located in Wayne National Forest in Scioto County, Ohio. We parked on the side of a paved road, grabbed our gear, took ATV trails from the main road about 1 mile west through thick forest, and reached the clearing in lakes. The fishing was good, and we had a great afternoon. Well, needless to say, the night descended upon us rather quickly. I voiced my concerns, but Bill, being very familiar with the terrain, was confident in getting us back. Fortunately, the moon was very bright that night, casting long shadows across the forest floor, and the way back was easily navigated. The scene was beautiful. Well, about a mile into the moonlit woods, Bill," and he says that this is a pseudonym, he doesn't name his friend here for specific reasons, "but Bill," he says, "stopped talking and pointed over his left shoulder into the woods and whispered, 'Look at that.' Now, I turned, and about 30 yards off to my left was some type of animal." I remember this story. It fascinates me, by the way. "Bill told me it was probably a wild cat and continued onward. Now, I was a bit nervous. I had never encountered a wild cat in the woods before and intended to move on and get away from it as fast as I could. We walked briskly ahead, and the supposed wild cat paced us. I thought that was kind of odd, and so did Bill. We knew something wasn't right. This is where it gets weird. He said, when we stopped, the creature stopped. But he said, we knew it was now a little closer, and it appeared bigger than any wild cat I'd ever heard of. Bill agreed. Again, in the moonlight, they can kind of see this animal. He said, not only did it stop, but it rose up on 2 feet and looked in our direction. Both Bill and I thought, oh crap, a bear. But it didn't have dark fur. They said that the fur was white or a light color. Now, I was a little freaked out by this time, and Bill pointed out something. He said the creature seemed to be mimicking our movements, and it did. To test this, Bill waved, and the animal waved. Then I waved, and it waved. By this time, we both freaked out again, and we ran. Well, the creature, they say, got on all fours, paced us, getting a little closer. Again, it stopped when we did and rose on 2 feet again. This thing had to be at least 7 to 8 feet tall when it stood up and covered in grayish-white hair, and we really couldn't make out facial features that well. It seemed like there were 2 dark spots where the eyes should be, but that was all we could make out. I'd never been so scared in my life. I thought we were both in big trouble. Both of us broke into a sprint and didn't stop until we were at the edge of the woods on the main road, not far from the car. We looked back the way we'd come, and the creature had gone. The creature was nowhere to be seen. It had disappeared." Now, he says, here's the additional story. By the way, I'm supposed to meet with Brother James down the mountain this August for coffee, and we've got some notes to compare about this story, my friend. Definitely do. But he says, here's the additional story and information. One day at a family gathering, my oldest brother and I were sharing strange stories, and he stated that in the late 1970s, there was a rash of Bigfoot sightings in my home county of Lawrence County, Ohio. He claimed the locals called it the Lawrence County Monster. I do remember something vaguely about the Lawrence County Monster, but I've never been sure about it, seeing as I was a wee lad in the 1970s. Well, here's his retelling of the story. In 1978, a group of his friends decided to go hunting in the woods adjacent to Wayne National Forest. Now, from what he recalls, there were four of them. And while they marched quietly through the forest, one of them noticed a tall, hairy man. One of the boys stated that the thing was about 7 to 8 feet tall. One witness, I'll call him Walt for this story, said that the creature stopped and stared at all four of them, and then it began walking in their direction. When the creature was about 20 yards ahead, one of the boys panicked and shot at this creature. Now, from what I was told, they were using buckshot, and when it didn't move, all of them opened fire on this animal. Well, it stopped and screamed so loud that it horrified all the boys. All of them agreed that this creature shook off all the buckshot and continued toward them. All of them turned and sprinted away back the way that they came, and halfway back, Walt turned and saw the creature had disappeared. They said, "That's all I know. What's fascinating is that my friend and I had an encounter in a stretch of woods close to that same area almost 20 years later. Is there a connection? I'll never know, but it's still fascinating." Now, I've since tried to find articles, James writes, about this Lawrence County monster online and failed. Apparently, the local paper, the Ironton Tribune, had published an article in the late 1970s on the Lawrence County monster, but I discovered there's only a limited amount of archived papers online. And so he concludes by asking, "Have you heard of any cryptid tales out of southern Ohio in or around the late 1970s? If not, not a big deal. It will be an interesting topic to research the next time I'm back home visiting. I hope you enjoyed this. And by the way, I'm still on for the meetup in August. I'll be back to you on the particulars. Many thanks to you and everyone at the Graylian Report. And thanks for all that you do. Your friend down the mountain, James." Well, James, as always, it is great to hear from you. Those stories are really fascinating to me. And again, your recollection of the animal that you and your friend saw, I mean, that's a really unusual story. And, you know, I mean, a part of me almost wonders, I mean, if it's mimicking your behaviors and things like that, I mean, is there the possibility even that it could be human? But, you know, here's the thing about that, too. I wonder the same thing about Sasquatch. I wonder sometimes if we're talking about something that behaves and acts so much like a human, could we actually be talking about humans? Because what we always see when we find hair samples, feces, things like that, it always comes back as registering as known species. And I even heard Dr. Jeffrey Meldrum in an interview say, could it be that we are looking at something so similar to humans that without any kind of a specimen, any kind of a type, when we conduct our DNA analysis, it is not easily differentiated from known animal species, and we don't presume that there's another ape species that exists in North America. And so all of the information we have points to human, and we interpret it as being such. What if it were indeed very different? That brings us back to my earlier question. I think about Neanderthal, Denisovan, you know, and other ancient Homo species, our ancestors. And I think, you know, again, how hairy were they? How much like us did they look? We can tell that there were some differences in their appearance based on what, you know, remains have been left in the fossil record. And as far as the Denisovans go, we don't have very much. As far as the Denisovans, all we have really are, we had at one time a fingertip from the so-called Woman X, and that had to be destroyed so that we could actually sequence the DNA, but we also have teeth, and we only have those teeth from two locations. Actually, that's not true. We only have teeth and some portions of what may be fragments of a skull, and those actually came from the type site, Denisova Cave. But what we do have, based on the DNA that was sequenced, is knowledge of where the Denisovans might have been based on their prevalence in DNA from modern humans. Again, that DNA was carried down, that of course being carried down from the mothers through the mitochondrial DNA, but we're nonetheless able to trace DNA of the Denisovans, and actually some make the argument that rather than the areas of Russia where we now find Denisovan remains, that actually their stomping grounds may have been Southeast Asia. You know, that's one theory, based on the prevalence of DNA in that area that's been carried on into modern human populations even today. Then again, though, we also have to say that, hey, let's say that they were really hairy and an awful lot like us. We're still able to differentiate them genetically from humans. Again, genome sequencing of Neanderthals and the Denisovans, I mean, it clearly shows that they are different both in appearance, probably in size too, but absolutely they are genetically distinct from humans. So the idea that Sasquatch would be so genetically similar to us that we wouldn't be able to tell the difference doesn't seem to hold water. We should be able to tell if there's a different creature. The problem is, I'm not a geneticist. You know, I don't have that kind of working knowledge. I'd love to talk to Todd Disotil, you know, someone like that. He would probably be able to clear up that matter for us and talk about really exactly how similar can a creature be to us before we can say that it is just us, or conversely, that we can say that it is not us. Again, I think genetically speaking, a chicken is like 99.9% similar to us, and chimpanzees are much more close than that. So imagine something that's even closer to us than chimpanzees. How would that register? What would that look like to us? My guess would be that it would have similar genetic characteristics to that of Denisovans or Neanderthal. But again, if we found evidence of something like that today, are modern geneticists going to say, oh, okay, this is weird. It looks like there are Neanderthals or Denisovans or some robust hominid out there marching around in our national parks in modern-day America. Who'd have thunk it? I mean, is that how they would react? Is there a sort of a wall that you hit logically where you're seeing that DNA evidence and you're going, this is impossible. That couldn't be what we're looking at. Therefore, it must be this. You know, I have questions about these things. That's a fascinating idea. And so when I say the way that you're describing what you saw, James, I mean, it makes me think, could we be looking at a human there? That doesn't mean I'm doubting your story. I mean, I'm literally asking, how much like us would a creature like that have to be before we would simply say, that's us, that's human, with a lot of hair on it? It would certainly seem to be something different. But then again, people who have their own personal encounters where they claim to see Sasquatch often say, I couldn't shoot this thing because it was human. I mean, what is human? Beyond that definition, there are certain anthropologists that are arguing that chimpanzees should start being called human. There are other anthropologists who say that chimpanzees are more like us, and therefore we should be called chimpanzees. Yeah, sometimes the lines get kind of blurred with these subjects, and that makes it all the more fascinating to me. Okay, when we come back after this, I want to talk a little bit about Kenneth Arnold. This Day in History presents a unique study in the history of ufology. We have audio sound bites and a lot to get into, and this is going to be a discussion unlike the likes of which you have probably heard in the past. Fundamental to this, what did Kenneth Arnold actually see, and did his narrative change over time? We'll look into that when we return here on the Graylian Report. Broadcasting from the high mountains of Appalachians, where it's very rainy above ground, I'm Micah Hanks. Welcome back. That's right, on this day in history, flying saucers enter the public zeitgeist, courtesy of one Kenneth Arnold of Idaho. And of all places, there was a very interesting article about this. And this was by Carl M. Cannon, who is the Washington Bureau Chief at Real Clear Politics, and Lauren was the very one that brought this to my attention, being the diligent research assistant that she is. Thank you, Lauren, as always. And by the way, we were hoping to get her on for a update because Lauren was in Denver, Colorado at the premiere of the new Missing 411 film. And she met and spoke with the father of the missing boy, Jared Atadero, Ron Moorhead, a number of others, too. And, of course, David Politis was there as well. But it was quite an event, and an eventful event at that. And so I was getting updates from her over the weekend, but I want to have her on for a full segment. Keep in mind, she's a family girl, and she's got two boys, one with a broken limb at home because somebody fractured his wrist recently, and I hope Mr. Matt is doing a lot better. And actually, I know he is because I've been checking in, making sure she's doing okay, too. But in the summertime, most mothers are doing double duty when the kids are home from school, right? So we totally understand. Nonetheless, she, of course, was sending along a bunch of stories this morning. And first thing this morning when I was asking about stories, she said, I've already got you know, my show prep in your email inbox. And I'm like, well, goodness gracious, I'm behind the curve, huh? And one of the things that she said was, you know, it was this day in history that Kenneth Arnold had his sighting. And she said, I liked this article, although it was the last place I expected to see one. Yeah, Real Clear Politics. So there's Carl Cannon, the Washington Bureau Chief for Real Clear Politics, writing about the Kenneth Arnold UFO sighting. Now, you'll find it probably kind of humorous because he has his own idea about what Kenneth Arnold might have seen, which he describes for us a little later, which we will get to in time. But I want to share a little of his article here. He says, on this day in 1947, as we know, an amateur pilot named Kenneth Arnold was flying his small plane from his home in Boise, Idaho, to an air show in Oregon. He had taken a slight detour en route, one necessitating that he look out his cockpit window with acute attentiveness. A U.S. Marine Corps transport plane had crashed recently in that area, and there was a $5,000 reward offered to anyone who found the wreckage. Now, although Arnold did not spot the Curtiss C-46, he did see something else interesting that afternoon. Not on the ground, but in the air. When he discussed it at a refueling stop in Yakima, Washington, Kenneth Arnold launched a new movie genre, a coast-to-coast craze and a national obsession with UFOs. Now, let's stop right there. That is true. Kenneth Arnold was the first guy to talk about seeing these things, and supposedly when he stopped and was very excitedly talking about what he'd seen during this refueling stop, by the time he gets back home, there are already members of the press waiting on him. The news had already spread. And the story goes that he already had people that were asking him questions. And so they're like, Mr. Arnold, what did you see? And he says, well, I don't know. There were some sort of aircraft. These planes, whatever they were, they didn't behave like any kind of planes I'd ever seen. Well, what did they behave like, Mr. Arnold? And of course, he said at that point, well, they moved back and forth and dipped up and down, kind of like a saucer skipping across the water. And that, of course, went down in history. That description. Flying saucers. Now, what's a little weird about all this is the fact that, of course, what he described initially was more like chevron-shaped objects. You know, these things were sort of like flying wings. They're very similar, in other words, to what we would recognize historically as the Horton Brothers designs for flying wings. Later on, as we would see, there would continue to be more and more reports of the so-called flying saucers, and at times it becomes rather difficult trying to make the distinctions. Who actually saw what appeared to actually be saucers, and who, on the other hand, merely saw aircraft they couldn't identify and called them flying saucers? That seems to be the big question. Now, at this point, I want to mention, by the way, and James, during the email segment, had said he couldn't find articles about this creature up there in his part of the country. Well, I could probably help with that some because being a newspaper hound, you know, and I love to fish for information on newspapers.com or ancestry.com or going to the National Archives website or, the Library of Congress, Chronicling America. A lot of free newspaper access is available there. I love going back and trying to find articles and things that talk about these kinds of subjects. And one of the earliest articles that appears via newspapers.com, and in fact, when I found this one, it actually, newspapers.com gives you so many great tools because it will help you find articles. You can list them in chronological order. There are a lot of advanced search features. But when you find one that appears to be really early, it will actually flag it for you and say, this appears to be the first article, chronologically speaking, that mentions the subject that you're looking for. And so I'll share with you now this article, and this one again, from June 24th, 1947. Well, actually, the date of the article is June 25th, but keeping in mind it's reporting what happened just the day before, and hence this is probably indeed the earliest report of this incident. One of them, there were a number of them, but this is right on the heels of what Kenneth Arnold said he saw. And this article out of Pendleton, Oregon, is titled Mystery Airplanes Seen Near Mount Rainier. Now, this is a UP report. Now, it's UPI these days, but it was a UP report back then. And it says, Kenneth Arnold, Boise, Idaho pilot, doesn't know whether to believe his eyes. He reported here today that while searching for a missing Marine Corps plane in southwestern Washington yesterday, he sighted 9 saucer-like objects flying at an amazing speed. Now, Arnold, who stopped here en route home to Idaho, said that the planes, and they put that in quotes, were sighted at about 3 p.m. yesterday at an altitude of about 10,000 feet. He clocked the strange appearing planes as they flew between Mount Rainier and Mount Adams and estimated their speed at about 1,200 miles an hour. "It seemed impossible," he said. "But there it is. I must believe my eyes." He said that the quote-unquote aircraft were extremely bright, as if they were nickel-plated, and appeared to weave in and out of formation. Arnold inquired about the mystery planes at Yakima last night and received only blank stares. But in Pendleton this morning, he said he talked with an unidentified man from Ukiah who reported he had seen similar objects yesterday afternoon in the mountains near Ukiah. Arnold is a Forest Service employee. And here endeth the reading. That is the report. So you can see that there's very little description in that article in terms of what Kenneth Arnold actually described having seen. But they nonetheless say saucer-like, which if we look back and we understand exactly what he was describing, those early accounts that he gave in other areas detailed something that skipped like saucers across water, or that they flew in a way, in a manner that was similar to that. A stone, if you skip stones across water and it kind of bounces up and down, that would be what he likened them to in terms of their locomotion. Now, we come back to the article earlier today from Carl M. Cannon at Real Clear Politics. And he goes on to say that by 1947, Americans were attuned to the awesome and sometimes frightening power of technology. Hiroshima and Nagasaki had taught everybody that lesson. And even before the Second World War, Orson Welles' 1938 War of the Worlds broadcast wasn't merely viewed as a metaphor for the destruction beginning to erupt around the globe. It was also a frightening campfire story about unknown threats from the heavens. In this milieu, Kenneth Arnold flew his small plane over Mount Rainier when something caught his eye. He saw the flash of a bright light with a bluish tinge, which he initially thought came from another airplane. Looking around, he saw a DC-4, which he estimated to be about 15 miles away, heading in the opposite direction. Then he saw another series of flashing lights, 9 in succession, and, even stranger, a series of airborne objects which he estimated were stretched over a distance of 5 miles. Moving in unison, they weaved from side to side, he said, darting like the tail of a Chinese kite. Attempting to calculate their speed, the pilot clocked how long it took the mysterious fleet to travel between Mount Rainier and Mount Adams and concluded that they were traveling 1,700 miles an hour. This assessment is what convinced some people and convinces UFO enthusiasts to this day that Kenneth Arnold was witnessing extraterrestrial avionics at work. That airspeed, after all, is more than twice the speed of sound, and Chuck Yeager wouldn't go supersonic for another 4 months. Now, he said, I think Arnold was looking at, you ready for it? Here we go. Here is what he thinks Kenneth Arnold saw. I think Arnold was looking at a flock of geese, and he miscalculated their speed because he misjudged how far away they were. But his imagination was off and running, and when he told the ground crews and hangers-on at the Yakima airstrip what he'd seen, they tended to believe him, or at least they passed it along. By the time Arnold arrived at the air show in Pendleton, Oregon, and we just read the report there, the actual UP report from that location, his tale had preceded him. A local reporter interviewed him. We just read that report. The story went out on the wires and made newspapers all over the country. What did that report say? Very little about how the objects actually looked. It only described them as saucer-like. Now, Arnold didn't really call the objects flying saucers. What he said was that they flew like a saucer being tossed across the water. So Carl Cannon does point that out. Famed CBS newsman Edward R. Murrow would later call this a historic misquote, but it seems to me that the paraphrase is pretty close, and that if there's a fault, it lies with Arnold. In any event, reports of flying saucers spiked in this country, and by the time a military weather balloon crashed outside Roswell, New Mexico, on July 8, 1947, witnesses immediately thought of flying saucers and spacemen. 2 days later, Harry Truman was asked about the phenomenon at a White House press conference. "Mr. President," he was asked, "have you seen any flying saucers?" And his response, and this is famous, was, "only in the newspapers," he replied, with a laugh. Now, of course, in the days that followed Kenneth Arnold's sighting, we had newspaper reports like this one, which appeared in the La Grande Observer in La Grande, Oregon. And it reads, at least 2 city residents recently reported that they had seen the silver-colored flying discs in the sky over La Grande, while a police patrolman told of sighting a strange perpendicular column of vapor at a great altitude. Meanwhile, at White Sands Proving Ground, New Mexico, the United Press reported that an Army rocket expert ventured the opinion that the flying saucers first seen by Boise salesman Kenneth Arnold were merely jet planes. Now, at this point, the article takes an interesting turn because the scope of this piece is actually quoting a local minister, a Reverend Lester Carlson of the Gospel Tabernacle at Le Grand. And they say Carlson said today he didn't know whether the mysterious speeding discs were natural phenomena or not, but there have been many other signs of the second coming of Christ. That's right. Recently, a colleague at Elgin reported seeing strange lights in the sky. The Gospel Tabernacle pastor explained. He said the Bible foretells the lights in Joel, where it says there shall be signs in the heavens above. And then later in the article, it also goes on to say that Russians might be to blame. So take your pick, Russians or the second coming of Christ. Although, interestingly, I was talking with Tim McMillan over the weekend, and we were trying to trace some of the ideas with regard to people at the Pentagon having the opinion that UFOs might represent some kind of demonic activity. Because, you know, there's been some discussion about this, and I think it's even been brought up in some of the episodes of the program Unidentified on History Channel. And I asked him, I said, are you familiar with Nick Redfern's book, Final Events, which he was not, and we talked about that a bit. And, you know, talking with Nick about that years ago, the premise of the book involved a government employee that reached out to Nick a number of years ago and told him, you know, look, there's this group in government with associations with the CIA and other organizations, if memory serves, and they were called the Collins Elite. And yeah, it had been their determination that the UFO mystery was demonic in origin. Again, make of that what you will. I don't put particular stock in the idea that demonic entities are controlling UFOs, but I will say this, that on this program, all the time, when we talk about the UFO subject on the show, all the time I get emails from listeners who write in, and that is their interpretation. Now, look, I'm not attacking anybody's beliefs. Many of them do get angry with me because they say, you just don't seem to get it. What you're talking about are demons, and I'm sure I'm inviting more emails. I guess we're all entitled to our opinions. My opinion is that that's not the best assessment of what we may be dealing with, unless demons have high technology at their disposal, right? But it seems to be the case that some in government actually are of that mind. That seems to be their own belief. Now, looking at some of the other articles from around that time, we've got this one too. And this is an article that first appeared in the Marysville Journal Tribune in Marysville, Ohio, and this the following month on July the 5th. So skipping ahead a few days now, they say in the Portland area, estimates of the number of saucers ranged all the way from 2 to 20, and none of the witnesses could give an exact description of the mysterious objects. So once again, we're faced with that conundrum here. Well, we're seeing things, but nobody's sure what they look like. The article goes on to say the Army's suggestion that they might be jet planes or jet exhaust was discounted by several Portland policemen who viewed them. For instance, Patrolman W.A. Lissy, who holds a private pilot's license and served in the Seabees during the war, said, quote, no jet plane would go through the maneuvers the discs described. Now, at the time, he admitted, quote, I could not tell whether they were shaped like balloons or saucers, nor could I tell how high they were. If somebody calls them meteorological phenomena, I won't argue about it. The article concludes by noting that the discs were first seen by, you guessed it, Kenneth Arnold. So I want to go to the audio sound bites at this point, and the first one we've got here is a phone interview. I believe, if memory serves, that this phone interview may have occurred like the day after the sighting. And this is one of three sound bites, actually, from audio interviews that Kenneth Arnold gave over the years that we're going to feature in our audio segment. So let's start right here, a news interview with Kenneth Arnold over the telephone describing what he saw on this date in history in 1947.
It was while I was searching for this crash that I noticed a terrific blue flash pass nose of my airplane. I noticed that the flash came from a very peculiar-looking object that were rapidly approaching Mountaineer at about 107 degrees. This chain of objects were nine in number. I assumed at the time they were a new formation or a new type of jet, though I was baffled by the fact that they did not have any tails. It passed almost directly in front of me, but at a distance of about 23 miles, which is not very great in the air. I judged their wingspan to be at least 100 feet across. Their sighting did not particularly disturb me at the time, except that I had never seen planes of that type. I never could understand at that time why the world got so upset about this, as these things didn't seem to be a menace. I believe they had something to do with our Army and Air Force. Now, of course, some of the reports they did take from newspapers, which did not quote me properly. Now, when I told the press, they misquoted me, and in the excitement of it all, one newspaper and another one got it so snarled up that nobody knew just exactly what they were talking about, I guess. These objects more or less fluttered like they were, I'd say, boats on very rough water or a very rough air of some type. And when I described how they flew, I said that they flew like you take a saucer and throw it across the water. Most of the newspapers misunderstood and misquoted that, too. They said that I said that they were saucer-like. I said they flew in a saucer-like fashion. I more or less have reserved an opinion as to what I think, naturally being a natural-born American. If it's not made by our science or our Army Air Forces, I'm inclined to believe that it's of an extraterrestrial origin. Well, I'll tell you this much. All the airline pilots, none of us have appreciated being laughed at. We made our reports essentially to begin with because we thought that if our government didn't know what it was only our duty to report it to our nation and to our Air Force out of it. I think it's something that is of concern to every person in the country. And I don't think it's anything for people to get hysterical about. Now, that's just my frank opinion of it.
Okay, so there we have Kenneth Arnold saying, look, I wasn't all bent out of shape over it, and if these things aren't our own, then I presume they must be extraterrestrial technology. You know, so the ET meme is being planted very early on. But what does he say? He says, I mean, they appeared to be what I thought were jets, probably our own. And yes, I was misquoted by everybody talking about the flying saucers. Now, many would look at this case and say, well, he was just mistaken, but he put the idea in people's minds that there were flying discs, and then shortly after that, everybody was seeing the things. Now, that is true, and we're going to hear some audio from others around that time, in just the days after Kenneth Arnold's famous historic sighting, who were saying that they were seeing similar things. But I first want to jump back in time, because we have this report from 1942, Major Ray Sabinsky, who was a World War II pilot who described his own encounter with an unusual object during the Second World War. These were referred to from time to time as Foo Fighters. And hearing his account is very interesting, but it's also relevant in the sense that for those who would say that the UFO enigma begins with Kenneth Arnold seeing geese flying over Mount Rainier, there's maybe a good case to be made that there were similar things being seen much earlier that were equally unidentified. We have that audio.
In 1942, in June, we went on the bombing mission. I was flying bombers, Wellingtons, over Ruhr, or otherwise so-called Happy Valley. And the trip was, we performed everything what was necessary, dropped the bombs on the target, and on the way back, while we were flying over the Zuider Zee, which is the part of Holland, my rear gunner reported an aircraft approaching from the rear. I told him that if this object comes too close, then we'll have to open the fire on him. And my idea was that perhaps it was a German fighter aircraft equipped with the searchlight in the nose. So when this thing came close, I wouldn't take any chance on it, and I told my rear gunner to give him a blast. So then he opened the fire on him, maybe 200 yards. And at that distance, this object was almost the size of the moon, which was also visible at the same time, maybe possibly a bit bigger. We used it tracers in the machine guns. There are four machine guns in the rear turret, and while this rear gunner was shooting, we could follow exactly the trajectory of the shells which were entering that particular target. Now, the peculiar thing about it was that those were just going in, and that was the end of it. They wouldn't fall down. so-called tracers. Those tracers would just enter, and that was it. Now, for that lasted for possibly, I don't know, maybe 2 minutes. And after that time, the shining object suddenly changed the position, and at a terrific speed moved over to our port side, almost at the same distance, about 200 yards from the wing. And then it stayed there. Of course, then both rear gunner and the front gunner opened the fire on my order, and I could see the tracers entering the target again from under two angles, at which I was sure that this was pretty close to 200 yards then, because you could see the angle of crossing the tracers. After a while, it moved up, took off at fantastic speed at the at least 45 degrees angle, and they just disappeared between the stars.
Obviously sounds a lot like a meteor, doesn't it, right? Taking off at a 45-degree angle and disappearing among the stars. I mean, who knows what he saw? But this audio soundbite from Major Ray Sabinsky describing, this wasn't recorded in, but it describes an event that occurred in 1942. Again, it definitely seems to entail an unusual aerial phenomena that was observed years before Kenneth Arnold's experience. Now, we go to the audio of another interview, this a later one, with Kenneth Arnold as interviewed by Bill Burkett, and this occurred on June 25th, 1947. So this interview occurs the day after his sighting. Again, one of the very earliest interviews that appears where he describes what he saw.
Newscaster in every newspaper across the nation has made headlines out of it, and this afternoon we are honored indeed to have here in our studio this man, Kenneth Arnold, who we believe may be able to give us a first-hand account and give you the same on what happened. Kenneth, first of all, if you'll move up here to the microphone just a little closer, we'll ask you to just tell in your own fashion, as you told us last night in your hotel room and again this morning, what you were doing there and how this entire thing started. Go ahead, Kenneth.
Well, at about 2:15, I took off from Chehalis, Washington, en route to Yakima. And, of course, every time that any of us fly over the country near Mount Rainier, we spend an hour or two in search of the Marine plane that's never been found that they believe is in the snow someplace southwest of that particular area. That area is located at about, or its elevation is about 10,000 foot. And I had made one sweep in close to Mount Rainier and down one of the canyons and was dragging it for any types of object that might prove to be the Marine ship. And as I come out of the canyon there, it was about 15 minutes. I was approximately 25 to 28 miles from Mount Rainier. I climbed back up to 9,200 feet, and I noticed to the left of me a chain which looked to me like the tail of a Chinese kite, kind of weaving and going at a terrific speed across the face of Mount Rainier. I at first thought they were geese because it flew like geese, but it was going so fast that I immediately changed my mind and decided it was a bunch of new jet planes in formation. Well, as the planes come to the edge of Mount Rainier, flying at about 160 degrees south, I thought I would clock them because it was such a clear day, and I didn't know where their destination was, but due to the fact that I had Mount St. Helens and Mount Adams to clock them by, I just thought I'd see just how fast they were going, since among pilots we argue about speed so much. And they seemed to flip and flash in the sun just like a mirror, and in fact I happened to be at an angle from the sun that seemed to hit the tops of these peculiar looking things in such a way that it almost blinded you when you looked at them through your plexiglass windshield. Well, it was about 1 minute to three when I started clocking them on my sweep secondhand clock, and as I kept looking at them, I kept looking for their tails. They didn't have any tails. I thought, well, maybe something's wrong with my eyes, and I turns the plane around and opens the window and looks out the window, and sure enough, I couldn't find any tails on them. And the whole observation of these particular ships didn't last more than about 2.5 minutes, and I could see them only plainly when they seemed to tip their wing or whatever it was, and the sun flashed on them. They looked something like a pie plate that was cut in half with a sort of a convex triangle in the rear. Now, I thought, well, that maybe they're jet planes with just the tail painted green or brown or something, and didn't think too much of it, but kept on watching them.
Okay, let me interject right there, because as he's making this description of what these aircraft look like, he initially says something like a pie plate. So, of course, some people would stop right there. Aha! Pie plate, right? Yeah, flying saucer. But what he actually describes is a pie plate, and if you cut that in half, and then he says there's some sort of a triangular shape in the back, I mean, that actually sounds more like certain kinds of swept wing aircraft designs that we see today. But keeping in mind that he didn't know at that time of the existence of any kind of aircraft, because at that time they weren't supposed to exist. But even Edward Ruppelt, in his famous report on unidentified flying objects, I mean, he described what he called a good UFO report from around that same time, and it described essentially the same thing. And so the question we're left with is, were there swept-wing aircraft that we didn't know existed at that time, but which, of course, would come along many decades later, nonetheless, that were being tested, experimental aircraft? Could these be the kinds of things that pilots, sometimes military pilots, but also civilian pilots like Kenneth Arnold, were actually seeing? If you really listen to the description that he gives, it sounds more like that than it does something unusual, or like a flying saucer. And last time I checked, geese don't reflect light like polished nickel. Just saying. We continue with the audio.
Well, they didn't fly in the conventional formation that's taught in our Army. They seem to kind of weave in and out right above the mountaintop. And I would say that they even went down into the canyons in several instances, oh, probably 100 feet. But I could see them against the snow, of course, on Mount Rainier, and against the snow on Mount Adams as they were flashing, and against a high ridge that happens to lay in between Mount Rainier and Mount Adams. But when I observed the tail end of the last one passing Mount Adams, and I was at an angle near Mount Rainier from it, but I looked at my watch and it showed 1 minute and 42 seconds. Well, I still thought, well, that's pretty fast, and I didn't stop to think what the distance was between the two mountains. Well, I landed at Yakima, Washington, and Al Baxter was there to greet me and saw up here. And he told me, I guess I better change my brand. But he kind of gave me a mysterious sort of a look that maybe I had seen something. He didn't know. And, well, I just kind of forgot it then till I got down at Pendleton, and I began looking at my map and taking measurements on it. And the best calculation I could figure out, now even in spite of error, would be around 1,200 miles an hour, because making the distance from Mount Rainier to Mount Adams, in we'll say approximately 2 minutes, it's almost, it'd be around 25 miles per minute. Now, allowing for error, we can give them 3 minutes or 4 minutes to make it, and they're still going more than 800 miles an hour, and to my knowledge, there isn't anything that I read about outside of some of the German rockets that would go that fast. These were flying in more or less a level, constant altitude. They weren't going up and they weren't going down. They were just simply flying straight and level, and I laughed and I told the pilots at Pendleton, I said, they sure must have had a tailwind, but it didn't seem to help me much. But to the best of my knowledge and the best of my description, that is what I actually saw, and like I told the Associated Press, I'd be glad to confirm it with my hands on a Bible, because I did see it, and whether it has anything to do with our Army or our intelligence or whether it has to do with some foreign country, I don't know. But I did see it, and I did clock it, and I just happened to be in a beautiful position to do it, and it's just as much a mystery to me as it is to everyone else who's been calling me the last 24 hours wondering what it was.
Now, of course, in the days that followed Kenneth Arnold's sighting, other people would naturally come forward and start saying they had similar experiences. This first report was from June 27, 1947. This one from Glen Falls, New York. Lewis Stebbins was the observer, and here is what Lewis claimed that he saw.
Whatever it was, certainly created a lot of interest. And I say whatever it was because, frankly, I am still wondering. It was on Friday night, the 27th of June, somewhere between 9:30 and 10 o'clock. Our neighbor, Mrs. Caffrey, my wife, and I were sitting on the porch when we saw this bright, shiny object moving in an arc-like path across the sky. The thing was about the size of an automobile headlight, and it appeared to be giving off a bright red fire from the front and blue from the back. We couldn't exactly say it was a flying disc we had been hearing about on the radio. Rather, we suspected it might have been a large meteor. I took a lot of kidding about the thing until the papers published a story about the American Meteor Society's report that a fireball, a type of meteor, may have landed that night in northern New York or Vermont. And I hope it was a meteor. Then maybe folks will stop phoning at 2 a.m. asking if I have found the cup to go with my flying saucers.
I always wondered about that. If there are flying saucers, where are the cups that go with them, right? Oak Ridge, Tennessee. Just 3 days later, on June 30th, 1947, Ernest Bremmett was the next who would give a report of something similar that he claimed he saw in the skies over North America.
Exactly when and where did you see your saucer, Mr. Bremmett?
It was about dark 2 weeks ago, the day before reports were carried in the papers all over the country. I saw it from the front porch in Elizabethton for about 5 seconds. The front part of the object was oval shaped. It was a dark bluish color and had a flaming red tail. It was moving horizontal to the earth just like an airplane, but it wasn't, for the light was quivering.
You say it had a red tail. Could it have been a falling star?
No, sir. I've seen many a falling star in my life, but never anything like this flying saucer before. It was too bright and too red to be a star.
Well, Warden Brummett, there's a rumor in these parts that the dancing disc might be atomic energy on the loose from Oak Ridge.
I don't believe that. If it had anything to do with atomic energy, the government would have announced it by this time, certainly.
Well, thank you, State Game Warden Ernest Bremmett.
State Game Warden Ernest Bremmett. Now, again, if you listen to what he says, the front part of the object was oval-shaped, and it had a bright red tail. And when asked Mr. Bremmett could it have been a meteor, he said no, it wasn't a meteor. But again, he's describing an object very similar to what Kenneth Arnold described. Now, that could mean one of two things. He had heard Kenneth Arnold's description, and that either influenced what he saw or perhaps his own description, and I don't want to make it sound like I'm saying he made this up, but again, we have to entertain that possibility that he might have heard Arnold's description and borrowed from that in relating his in any capacity, or what he saw was indeed a half-moon-shaped, dark blue-colored object with a red fiery tail. Does that sound at all like the jet thrusters on an F-15 that you'd see even today? You know, that's the thing I'm trying to point out, is that what they described sounded not so much like aircraft from another world, but aircraft several decades in advance of what we knew to exist at that time, 1947. And that's really fascinating, because on review of, and I reread this book every now and then, just to kind of refamiliarize myself with what he had to say, but Edward Ruppelt's book from 1956, if memory serves, The Report on Unidentified Flying Objects. In that book, he describes similar quote-unquote good UFO reports that describe what sound like aircraft many years in advance of anything that should have existed in 1947, although, as I mentioned earlier, there had been prototype designs by the likes of the Horton brothers that had at very least introduced these concepts, but they were not known to exist in 1947. And one interpretation of some of the UFO sightings occurring in this era is that we're seeing the introduction, the beginning, in other words, of black programs, where there were highly sophisticated new aerial technologies being developed, which somehow remained off the books and continue to remain off the books to this day. But by the time the late 1980s rolls around and you look at the Spirit, you know, the stealth bomber, all of a sudden these tailless aircraft that have a half-moon shape in the front and that have a fiery red tail in the back, they don't sound quite so esoteric any longer, do they? And so, in hindsight, looking back, the idea of the flying saucer, again, the disc shape, preeminently associated with the aircraft in these cases. Not to say that there haven't been some cases over the years that actually describe disc-shaped aircraft. But again, that term enters the public zeitgeist as a result of the description that Arnold gave, and he even pointed out, as we've heard in the audio soundbite, that he had been misquoted in that regard. Now I want to skip ahead to 1977. And here is an additional statement from Kenneth Arnold, where he had been interviewed by an Australian film crew. And he is continuing after all those years to argue about the disbelief. He's angry about the disbelief in his account and people arguing that what he'd actually seen were, you know, geese flying over Mount Rainier, or even, this is another even more ridiculous interpretation of that sighting, that maybe it had been snow blowing off the mountain peaks that he had seen. I mean, imagine that you have seen a group of what appear to be experimental aircraft. You know, you're open to the idea that they could be extraterrestrial, but your first inclination is to think that this is probably your own military, like he said. And for years, people make you out to be a nutcase and try and tell you that you saw everything except what you thought you saw. He even said at one point in one of the interviews, Arnold did, "At first I thought I was looking at geese, but it was evident to me after watching them for 2 minutes that that's not what I was seeing." And people still try to say that, yeah, I'm pretty sure he was looking at geese. So in 1977, they catch up with Kenneth Arnold, and he's still a little bitter about the fact that people, after all these years, continue to doubt what he says he saw.
This man started the 1947 wave of sightings that swept the world when he claimed to have seen from his mountain rescue plane 9 disc-like objects, roughly 45 miles away, flying at a speed of approximately 1,500 miles per hour near Mount Rainier, Oregon. The date? June 24, 1947. Later, when asked by a reporter to describe how they flew, Arnold said their motion was like saucers skipping over water. In the papers the next day, the world first saw the term flying saucer. On June 24, 1977, 30 years to the day after he first sighted them, Ken Arnold consented to speak to us. He had refused to make any public statements for the last 5 years. It's easy to see that after 30 years, he's still angry at the disbelief.
Right here, we've seen something. I've seen something. Hundreds of pilots have seen something in the skies. We have dutifully reported these things. And we have to have 15 million witnesses before anybody's going to look into the problem. Seriously? Why, this is utterly fantastic. This is more fantastic than flying saucers or people from Venus or anything, as far as I'm concerned.
I might have to agree with him on that one. Again, there is so much evidence, and actually, we're starting to finally see that change. Kenneth Arnold himself would not live to see that change, but what he is describing, and this is fascinating to me, less than being extraterrestrial technologies, which even he entertained that possibility himself, as we have heard, what he seemed to describe was a technology that was several decades in advance of what was known to exist at that time. And so, in light of recent discussion of UFO technologies, some of them perhaps being our own, maybe that idea really isn't that far out. Maybe it never was. And it just goes to show that the way that these subjects become stigmatized over time does more harm than good in terms of bringing broader public awareness to the real issues at hand. Maybe we've been seeing something in our midst for a long time that could be far closer to home. We just don't know. But I think that Kenneth Arnold's core statements ring true over all these decades. And I think that he was right. It's more astounding that people continue to ignore it than the idea that there's something unusual in our skies. That'll have to be the final word for this week's edition of the program. On behalf of all of us here at Graylian International Studios, Chris Hayes, Caleb Hanks, Tyler Pittman, Jeremy London, Rayson Robin Hobbs, Dick Oakley, John Anderson, Jason Pentrell, James Waldo, Tiffany Mack, the lovely assistant Lauren, the Graylian Reverend Matthew Oakley, and yours truly, I am Micah Hanks. We will catch you guys next time, and as always, stay strange out there.